This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum. And our call today is talking about challenges of integrating and managing renewable energy within a muni. Our presenters are Richard Chase with Chase Systems, Dick White and Doreen Green Global Consulting, and Jerry Braun, Integrated Resources Network. And we're going to take Richard Chase first, and then Dick, if he is here, we'll take him second, and then Jerry, if you wouldn't mind finishing up at the end.
Yep. Dick is here.
Okay, good. And I'm going to mute everybody right now. So if you need to talk, go ahead and do a four and then a star, and that will unmute your line. And Richard, I just unmuted your line for you.
Thank you. I'm Richard Chase. I am a commissioner at the Princeton Municipal Light Department in Princeton, Massachusetts, and we have had a significant history with renewable energy and the Princeton Municipal Light Department. We serve a little under 1,500 customers, been around 100 years plus, so we're a small rural utility, and and this goes back to the 80s, for a brief history, the MWEC, which is the Massachusetts Municipal Wholesale Electric Company, was pushing munis to buy into Seabrook, a nuclear power station in Seabrook, New Hampshire, when that was being built. A group of citizens went to the Princeton commissioners and were strongly opposed to buying into Seabrook. And so as an alternative, they put up the first wind farm east of the Mississippi in 1984. Then, first time around, I was a commissioner. In 2001, one of the other commissioners who runs an electric motor, industrial motor business, who had rebuilt the wind turbines multiple times, said, we really can't rebuild these anymore. So at that point, started a project to replace them with modern wind turbines, which went before the town. It was voted 72% in favor of replacing the turbines with modern turbines. The project took a substantial amount of time and was quite expensive. We now have two 1.5 megawatt Furlander turbines on the same site as the original wind turbines that would provide roughly 27% of the town's electricity. And unfortunately, the costs on the project were substantially more than the projected costs. So we currently have the dubious honor of some of the highest electric rates in the state, not necessarily in the country, but we've got quite a few of those beat too. So we do integrate relatively easily. The turbines are registered with ISO New England as generation sources. Part of the power is used in town. Part of the power is sold to nearby munis on a PPA basis, a unit contingent basis, which means when the units generate, we will sell you power. We're not required to buy replacement power. And many of these are covered by the various supply contracts that we have. And that really gets to one of the key points of any of these munis, is the supply contract is very key as far as integrating renewable energy. If you haven't read the supply contract, as much as it's not exactly thrilling reading, I strongly recommend you get a copy of that. That is a public record, so I believe in any state you should be able to ask for a copy and they should just give it to you. If they are hesitant, you can emphasize a Freedom of Information Act request, at which point they will just simply give it to you because it's not worth fighting. So those are a couple things. The next is that having votes on the body that authorizes those contracts, typically in our case, the Board of Lake Commissioners, which I am one member of three, are elected volunteers for a three-year term. Each one commissioner is up for election each year. So with that, the most direct way is getting people that you would support on the board, because that, and part of the problem is the people selling these contracts want to lock you in for a ongoing all requirements contract to basically block you from doing or the muni from integrating in distributed energy either on a customer's premise or on a wholesale commercial basis. So these are some of the challenges you will have. The difficulty with a residential system is its costs are 2 to 3 times what a solar field commercial type system will cost. And hence the costs for the power you'd be supplying to the muni are substantially different. And that's why, you know, as was being chatted about a few minutes ago, the munis, and in fact all the utilities are saying, well, we can get renewable energy less expensively than net metering, which is true. So that is a reality, but we have to work out how you balance all the different needs. And there have been various value of solar studies, which is a whole another topic for another call, Sierra. But essentially, the utilities would probably look at it as, well, this is bulk power. We're buying power. This is what we can get it from these various folks from, you know, various suppliers, which may be small hydro plants in New England, solar field projects, wind projects, all these different things. So you have to really work to incorporate all these things. And as a recent study came out, said we should be able to get to 90% clean energy by 2035. Massachusetts has requirements for both renewable energy and clean energy. Clean energy, the difference being nuclear, is considered clean, even though its construction and decommissioning have substantial emissions, and the fuel cycle has substantial emissions. The actual operation has hopefully minimal emissions. So that's the, and we're looking right now, we have a supply contract that runs another 7 years. There was a discussion on the previous call about Kentucky where they are trying to sign them up for 10-year contracts with 100% coal-fired. Obviously, that's not a win for people who would like to see more renewable energy. So that's my two cents on it, Sierra.
Yes, you were talking just for a second here about some of the people on the board that were giving you trouble. Do you want to explain that a little bit, the importance of that? Just a minute.
Well, the there's, as a small muni, the board members are local residents, and you will have a substantial diversity of opinion on which much of it relates to political stuff, perspective on energy and where it should be, where it should come from, and So it makes for contentious elections, shall we say. I have the honor of having the second most contentious election in the last probably 20 years to be on the Board of Commissioners.
Okay. And Dick White, I just unmuted you. Would you like to go ahead and talk a little bit about what's happening over in your neck of the woods in Colorado?
I'll give you a little background. Last year I finished two terms, that's 8 years, on the City Council of Durango, Colorado. I was the mayor for 1 year in each of those terms. So I was somewhat familiar with what the city was doing. One of the things that we did early in my first term was to renew our franchise agreement with a local electric co-op, La Plata Electric Association. And that franchise agreement runs until 2032. And at that time, that was 2011 or so, 2012, that we could see changes going on in the utility industry, but although Boulder, Colorado was at that time initiating an effort to essentially divorce from their investor-owned utility and establish their own municipal utility, we just didn't see that as a viable alternative for our community. We are, I should mention, we're a community of about a little under 20,000 people. Our entire county has a population of 55,000. And I think, having lived in Massachusetts, our county is not as big as the state, but it would be a substantial fraction of that. The population density here is a lot lower. Anyway, the franchise agreement essentially ties the electrical distribution of that we get in the city of Durango to our local electric co-op. They have a long-term contract with a transmission and generation cooperative that runs until 2050. That's another 30 years from now. Issues that Richard talked about a board and contention, has been very much alive here. I was part of a local smart energy group shortly after I arrived in Durango 17 years ago that was beginning to work with the co-op to say, hey, folks, there are changes coming in terms of climate change and a need to change the utility industry. And at that time, they weren't interested in listening. One of our activist members got elected to that board, but for 6 years, I believe, unless it was nine, he was the only, if you will, progressive member of that board. And it's only later that elections have changed. The board swung decisively to a smart energy majority now 2 years ago, and they finally said, wait a minute, we need an ambitious renewable energy target in aligned with the Sierra Club 100% by 2050. Until that happened, and I was the mayor when we first got a citizen petition to say, well, set this target, and there was no way to get there with our constraints with our co-op. Once the co-op board changed and they set this renewable energy target, the current city council that was elected last year has in fact adopted that 100% renewable goal by 2050, and the city had already set a target of 25% on-site renewables by 2025. There's progress going on internally towards that. The 2019 budget had investment grade audit. I just this morning got an update from the sustainability coordinator. The completion of that audit and the recommendations has been delayed because of the pandemic. And so They were expected to begin a performance contract with them this week, actually. That has been delayed, but the goal then is that they will have performance contracting with this group. It's McKinstry, and they will be starting to implement the most cost-effective actions of the city, which will include a megawatt of generation capability on city facilities. However, we are still limited because the long-term contract between the Florida Electric Association and Tri-State Generation and Transmission, which is the cooperative of rural co-ops that provides the transmission and generation, that very long-term contract restricts local co-ops to no more than 5% local generation. And La Plata Electric long since hit that cap. They are now agitating with Tri-State either for a revision of the contract or terms of breaking the contract, and so we can go out in the open market and purchase power. And there are now, I believe, two of what had been 44 co-ops which have completed that process. La Plata and one other is in process with that, and there are cases about saying, all right, give us a reasonable cost that are pending before the Colorado Public Utilities Commission and also in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Tri-State actually appealed to the federal board saying, well, we operate in more than one state. We can't just deal with one state's regulations. That looks like a subterfuge to avoid the regulation locally, but that's my opinion anyway. Anyway, that has been a major obstacle to the expansion of renewable energy. Integration is not our issue because we're not operating municipal utility. That's up to the co-op. But they are progressive. They've hired a very progressive CEO, very knowledgeable, and she is being very energetic around this. Meanwhile, the city is doing what it can. We've got we're looking at micro hydro and the water distribution system because we've got a potential new water treatment plant coming online, possibly within a few years. We have a recent wastewater treatment plant expansion, and they've doubled the methane capture ability. They basically put in a second biodigester, and the methane is being used to offset the power consumption by the utility. We've got a number of behind-the-meter projects that don't come in under the 5% limit, but there are also facilities that don't have room on site for solar, but we have another site that has ample room where we can put in the generation, but it's more than the load of the water treatment plant, for example. So there are constraints there. But given the progressiveness of our co-op board at this time, and I don't foresee that changing, and I think the opportunities will continue to increase, and the very rapid drop in the cost of renewables is making this a very promising environment going forward that we really can make significant impacts on climate change, which is ultimately my motivation for being involved in this sector at all.
All right. Thanks so much. Jerry, do you want to go ahead and say something here? And I'm unmuting your line for you. Go ahead.
Yes, I will. Thank you, Sierra. Both Richard and Dick, both of you have a really excellent, point of view, perspective, I guess, where you sit and looking at these issues. I think we have similar issues. Where I live in California, I'm in Yolo County, which is right next to Sacramento, and we have a large municipal utility in Sacramento that we are not part of, but we do have a community choice agency, a joint powers agency that serves Yolo County, and we have, you know, through that quite a bit of flexibility to, you know, to basically adjust our electricity portfolio to what the public wants and the goals that our board sets. Just as kind of background, I serve on the City of Davis Utilities Commission. We are a city of about 70,000 people, and Yolo County is about 250 or something like that population, 250,000 population, a relatively small county in California. And I also serve on the advisory committee for the Valley Clean Energy, which is the community choice agency I mentioned. So I have a somewhat similar vantage point to Richard and Dick. What I take from the, you know, from both of you is what I've experienced myself, and that is that, you know, we live our history in these matters. You know, things get decided early, and positions get taken early, and decades ago, and they kind of just play forward. I'll just kind of go through some of the things that have happened here. I think we're kind of ground zero of a cold war between the investor-owned utilities and munis, and it kind of plays out the Sacramento utility SMUD versus PG&E, the notorious PG&E. Interestingly, SMUD launched the country's first rooftop solar deployment program in probably around 1980, and it was somehow related to their having attempted to build a nuclear power plant and having to abandon that. And the interesting thing about their solar program was that the utility owned the systems on rooftops. So there was already a vulnerability there, and the IOU, PG&E, then tried to take over the muni's operations, which failed. And the muni, in turn, tried to annex Yolo County, which failed, and a lot of money got spent on those two abortive attempts. And then, I showed up about 13 years ago, and kind of in time for our city's attempt to municipalize. Kind of the community choice was an option, but city managers thought, well, why not go all the way and go for municipalization? That failed, and we then brought up the possibility of doing community choice and managed to get that across the finish line with the city, and the city then brought the county in and some other cities. And so we now have a community choice program, and one of the first things that our community choice agency did with PG&E's bankruptcy in front of us was to bid to acquire PG&E's local distribution assets in our county. So you can see that, we've had similar issues. What I want to make a couple of observations about municipal utilities, and I want to ask if you would kind of reflect on them as to whether, you know, you're seeing similar things. One of the folks on the call mentioned that I was kind of surprised that municipal utilities in his area are kind of anti-rooftop solar. And in fact, the former CEO of the municipal utility was kind of brutally opposed. Basically, said solar is less effective than trees shading roofs. So we have an interesting situation that is kind of counterintuitive. My observation is that municipal utilities are in our area, and there are probably about 15 or so in Northern California, generally in a position to significantly undercut investor-owned utility rates. They serve compact service areas, lower transmission costs, and they are not, I think it's kind of a hidden factor that they are not incented as public entities to acquire assets. And to some extent, the investor-owned utilities have to acquire assets. They have to earn money on those assets, the only way they can earn money for their shareholders. And so there's a built-in competitive advantage on cost. But unlike investor-owned utilities, munis, the kind of the latest twist, I think, is that they have pension obligations, and so do municipalities, and that really affects the thinking. It kind of concentrates the mind on cost and on revenues. So municipal utilities are, at least in the ones that I'm familiar with, and by the way, the Sacramento Municipal Utility actually, was basically operations for the Community Choice Program were turned over to that utility, and so they're handling all of the wholesale power procurement for the Community Choice Program. But munis are staffed to do what Community Choice Programs aspire to do, but in my experience, they don't, and I think I want to speculate on why. They aren't subject to as much state policy influence, and our state certainly has been kind of at the tip of the spear in terms of renewable deployment and so forth. And they also, munis tend to exploit a distrust of state government and especially a distrust of for-profit utilities. Right now, the municipal utility I mentioned is advocating very strongly and offering very significant incentives for heat pumps and electric vehicles. And they are doing as much as they can, in spite of public sentiment, to kind of discourage investments in on-site solar. And, I guess the question is this consistent? Is it rational? They are a very proud green utility. But I think it is rational, and it's about maximizing revenues and minimizing costs. And they are very concerned about the possible, the effect of people having solar on their roofs eroding their revenues. So I think generally in California, the external message that the munis have is, we keep your electricity costs low. We're cheap. And that becomes the internal message, which is take care of costs, revenue, and pension obligations, and everything else will take care of itself. I guess my question is there any evidence that any of this might be, valid outside of Northern California, or are we kind of unique? So that's what I can offer at this point.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. I'd like to open this up to anybody else who might have some comments on this, as well as Dick and Richard. And if you want to talk, please unmute your lines doing a 4 and a star, and then I can call on you when it's appropriate. So anybody, comments, Dick or Richard at this point? No comments? Come on, guys.
Well, I was just fiddling with I was unmuted and thought I was muted. The issue around optimizing the system is a challenging one. The Rocky Mountain Institute a few years ago did a study on, I think it was entitled The Economics of Grid Defection, and they basically said a totally grid-dominated system and totally off-grid are two poles, and the sweet spot is in the middle in terms of the long-term cost-effectiveness of the whole system. And so I think that we're all in this area of balancing the distributed energy generation, which we're allowed to get, which is, you know, one of the constraints here. The drive was, all right, put on rooftop solar because it's what you, it's the renewable you can get. We do have a couple of solar farms on our system, but they've now maxed out what we're allowed under this long-term contract. One of the goals of our utility now is to maximize the amount of local generation and the local economic development that goes with that. And that's a major consideration. The other piece of that is we have a terrific solar resource in Southwest Colorado, and so we have a very ample opportunity for local generation, but we've got to get out from under the institutional constraints. The other local piece and the idea about heat pumps in particular and vehicle electrification, the beneficial electrification is the buzzword right now in terms of getting greater efficiency using electricity, particularly renewably generated electricity, to minimize transportation emissions and also heating emissions. One of the big challenges in terms of climate is to say, wow, we've got a huge amount of investment in the energy consumption in our buildings, most of which is locally provided by natural gas. And if we're going to meet climate targets, we need to address that issue, which I think in just building efficiency and changing energy sources is a long-term challenge.
This is Craig Lewis. I've got a comment or two if I can jump in.
Yes, please.
Excellent. The first thing I want to say is I want to thank the speakers who have been really pushing the envelope in some cases for decades. I know Jerry's just been doing tremendous work out in the Sacramento Davis area for a long time, and it was interesting to hear there were things in his experience I wasn't even aware of, and I've known him for a long time. Thank you to all of you for pushing things forward here. One of the challenges that the Clean Coalition has found, and by the way, if I didn't say it, this is Craig Lewis, the Clean Coalition. One of the experiences we've had is we've run into the limitations with the where you have a municipal utility and they're bound by some contract with the generation and transmission utility, as the gentleman commented, with constraints from Tri-State. We have been involved in negotiations with those G&T utilities in order to get them to agree to loosen up some of the constraints. Generally, you can do things behind the meter up to a megawatt, but if you come in front of the meter, those contracts usually have constraints. Sometimes you can't do anything. In my experience, there's been some receptivity from those G&T utilities. And I think ultimately because they know that if you did fight the battle all the way to the federal level, that the local municipal utility would probably win. the other thing I wanted to just jump on was something that Jerry brought up, which is at the end of the day, the municipal utilities kind of have they're kind of caught in the same constraints of looking at the economics as the investor-owned utilities are. And that's really unfortunate because, you know, the intuition would say municipal utilities are looking out for the best interest of their constituents, and they don't have to, you know, pay a royalty to Wall Street, you know, in the form of dividends, et cetera. But at the end of the day, I have found, and the Clean Coalition has found more generally, that municipal utilities are still really focused on the economics, and partly because they like to be cheaper than the surrounding investor-owned utilities. They also are sometimes more averse to taking risks and trying new things because they tend to be of the mindset that, hey, let the investor-owned utility over here that's going to be forced to do something creative, let them do the creative thing, bring the learning, travel up the learning curve, travel down the cost curve, and then we'll be able to adopt it, you know, 5-10 years from now when everything's cheaper and we keep our costs down relative to our neighboring investor-owned utilities. That is really unfortunate thinking, and it's hard to find exceptions. There are exceptions out there, but it's hard to find them. And so I've come to the conclusion that the munis aren't really that much easier or better to work with than the investor owns. There was one more thing I wanted to comment on. What was it? I've lost my train of thought, so I'll leave it at that, and I'll chime in again if I need to.
I have one question for everybody. Is breaking the agreement cost effective to be able to obtain renewable energy? Anybody has any thoughts on that? Anyhow, James, you had some questions. Why don't you go ahead and ask some? Well, no, somebody opened the line there. Go ahead.
Well, I did, and I guess what I see happening. And it may be just in California, but I've been in the utility in and out of the utility industry for a few decades. And when a few decades ago, the cost structure or the cost buildup, if you will, that goes into rates, was dominated by generation costs. 70% of the cost to the customer was generation. And about maybe 20% distribution and 10% transmission. And, of course, you know, that may have been high because of California being so spread out. But now it's more like more than 50% transmission and distribution. Generation is more, you know, the new generation is probably closer to 15 to 20%, the old generation might be 20 to 30%, because solar and wind have come down so fast as far as utility scale is concerned. And then you have a bunch of costs that never were there decades ago, public benefits and low-income customers and energy efficiency and all that. So the cost structure has really changed a lot. And I think this needs to be accounted for by the utility, certainly, but also in terms of how you look at on-site generation. You know, you are basically, if all you're getting credit for is the 20% of the total cost that comes from, you know, imported energy that comes over the county line, you're probably missing the big picture, because the big picture is not just trying to keep generation costs contained, but also transmission and distribution costs. And I know Craig has done a lot of work on that and has had some very serious headwinds in trying to do that. I hope that work continues because it's really crucial. So I just wanted to kind of make a comment about the cost structure and how it's shifting. And I will say also that, that, you know, everybody's really impressed by the fact that utility scale solar costs have come down, and they have come down a lot, but the costs of community scale solar and residential scale solar have come down by the same percentages. And what that means is that the difference between the cost of wholesale utility scale and, if you will, retail, community, or building scale, is really not that much. And so, again, with that change, that just kind of adds to the need to consider how, you know, the relative costs have shifted as far as the, you know, traditional utility cost bill. Anyway, I'm sorry for I got off on a little tangent there, but I hope it was helpful.
Your tangent's always worthwhile, Jerry. Don't worry about that.
Hello, this is Tom Cabot.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Thanks. So this is Tom Cabot out in Menlo Park, and thought I'd share a couple ideas, too. I also have 4 decades now in utility experience, mostly in the municipal side, and so I can see the parallels of interest between municipal utilities and IOUs. And then also I do a lot of work now on electrification policy for cities, trying to help them look at this thing. And I think we have to start looking at what are the levers cities can pull, and then what is the strategy judo that we ought to pursue in order to get these dominoes falling the way that they have to help consumers and solve the climate problem. I think a lot of us, even at the consumer level, we look at everything in the wrong silos. We think of putting solar on our roof first just to cover our Game Boy or our plug loads and things like that before we do electrification. But if some of the municipal entities involved who have the ability to pass ordinances about the installation of solar can flip the script on what it takes, you know, what is the regulatory requirement going to be to install rooftop solar, and flip it around to removing all kinds of obstacles and then making only one requirement in the interest of the climate. And that is, yes, you can put on rooftop solar, and but only if you are also electrifying the water heating with heat pumps and the space heating, et cetera. And so make the carbon saving, climate saving, volume producing action be part of the permission to install the rooftop solar. And then we can get the volumetric interests of municipal utilities and CCEs and investor-owned utilities aligned towards pursuing the package of the solar plus the electrification together. Otherwise, what I notice is people solarize their house and it covers their plug loads, and then they claim they've run out of roof space, so they don't want to electrify anything else because they'd have to buy juice from the utility, and that's not, you know, they don't feel like doing it. But so if we can convert those from don't feel like doing it to, yes, it's part of the package, that's how you have affordable decarbonization and how you get the permission to do all the solaring you like to do. So if folks can be looking for how to encourage their municipals to tie solar permission and electrification together, then I think we can make joint progress across a lot of fronts.
All right. I'd like to call on James Orenstein. You had some questions that you sent me. Why don't you go ahead and ask those now?
This is James Orenstein. I'm from the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. And the question I asked earlier has already come up in several different forms. Locally here, there's a city called Denton, and they have a municipal utility that they claim to be 40% renewable several years ago, and now they claim to be 100% renewable. And there's some complications to that claim. But basically, so their claim is that even if your goal is to get renewable energy, that they can supply it cheaper by supplying you with their, utility scale renewables rather than paying net metering for rooftop solar or providing incentives for people to install. And they've traditionally had very generous installation incentives, and they were doing, we call a buyback plan here because of the dual register electric meters. You can't really do actual net metering, but in any case. So they had relatively generous plans, but now they're reconsidering everything. And they're trying to figure out what it's really worth to them to have the local generation. And some of their thinking has been that they should be reimbursing at the wholesale rate. Whereas you've got Austin is a prime example in this area where they're tied into some long-term fossil fuel generation costs. So they can't make the claim that they can supply 100% renewable energy, but they've done some kind of a value of solar calculation that, you know, it doesn't come out to be full retail, but it's a lot more than wholesale. So I don't know how you influence a local utility to correctly value the solar.
Anybody comments on either one of these two people? Somebody was starting to talk. Anybody?
Well, this is Tom Cabot again. I'd say the way you influence municipal utilities is you attend their public meetings and you use your public comment time to state the case and make the request and try to show them how it's in their interest. That we see that working out here when I worked for one.
Yeah. I'd like to, Tom, I wanted to just comment on your idea about how you can be more integrative about solar and electrification. I've done a couple of projects where my goal was to get to a net zero campus or a net zero building. And one of the things that I think would be really helpful would be not to have to size the solar array based on your historical usage, and that's the rule in California, like last year's usage. So you do that, and then when you electrify, because typically you replace appliances when they break or what have you, when you add the electric vehicle or when you switch over from a gas furnace to a heat pump, then you have to add another solar array. And that basically penalizes the economics of the whole thing, because then you have two undersized solar arrays that you paid for paid more for because they were undersized. You still have plenty of roof space left over. And, it's not an economically good process if your goal is decarbonization. I think there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done, and I think you had a good suggestion that somehow get people to think, no matter what they're doing, whether they're thinking about solar or whether they're thinking about appliances, to think about the whole system and how are you going to get to zero carbon. I think that's really what you want, but you also have to change some current rules or that isn't going to work. At least in California.
Right. I agree with what you're pointing out there, Gary. And so, one of the things maybe I didn't make clear was perhaps the requirement would be you can install rooftop solar and you must, as part of the system, install the conduit to the water heater location and the conduit the EV charger location. And so not forcing the conversion at the same moment, but forcing the readiness to be there, because we have so many cases where the gas water heater burns out and they can't get the water heat back on in time to save the marriage if they were to convert to electric. They can only do it with gas. And so, we've got these short turnarounds with emergency replacement. So getting and maybe it's pre-wiring for the electrification in as a requirement just seems like an easy lift. Since solar installation companies were always out there doing the 240-volt circuits anyway the solar. Why not do two more, one to the water heater, one to the EV garage location?
Yeah, I think it needs to be kind of make everything zero carbon ready, both solar and the appliances, and try to do it in one shot, and provide some incentives so that it isn't something that people look at and say, oh well, I just really want to do this one thing, and I don't want to pay extra to do this other thing, So I think the whole process needs to be rethought, and of course, cities and counties need to help that because they enforce the codes and so forth. Utilities, at least so far here, are just basically making sure that the installations are safe.
Right.
I'd like to, I'd like to save this discussion for actually July 14th, where it would be something we should get into in more depth, because we're talking about on July 14th a system for determining the least cost, highest performing building designs, including net zero energy and minimum CO2. So Rob Hammond and Ian Hammond Hogan are going to be talking from Bureau of Energy, and they've done some research, and well, they actually have created a tool or a process. They're working with the state of California, so this topic would certainly fit in more with that. Any more comments about municipalization? Or municipal utilities and renewable energy? Anybody? Okay. Getting back to the question I had earlier, and one person brought up the possibility of breaking the contract, would it be cost-effective to do that? It seems like that would be a way of obtaining more renewable energy if you have an obstruction contract. Anybody, any thoughts on that, Jerry?
Well, you know, I guess you can't know the answer to that until you start the negotiations, and you know, but it certainly seems like you would start to have that discussion, you know, because, you know, there's everything is changing. And so I think you would expect that the, you know, the generation co-ops and what have you are rethinking their long-term strategy just like everybody else. And so I think the start the conversation in terms of where are you heading and where would we like to head? And is there any way we can, you know, get out of each other's way? You know, I really do think that's where you would start.
Okay.
So I agree that's where you start in maybe a bilateral discussion. But there was another technique that that's possible, and that is you undermine the funding source for the contract. And so you put the contract at risk, which, you know, you have to talk to your folks about how to go about doing that. But if the buyers end up passing ordinances where they're or rules or RPS standards where they're not going to be allocating much money for these contracts, that shakes the confidence in the seller that the seller has for how much product they can deliver to somebody who's moving their budget priorities around. So you can try this from the buyer side to undermine that, or to, you know, fail to get appropriations for payment, and you know, take the hard path.
Yeah,
that's a really good idea, Tom. And that's actually what the city of Boulder did right then. They're going through a municipalization process, and I think they actually have the determination to get it done. But they've been doing it for the last 5 years, and they've probably got a couple more to go. But the city of Boulder, they were coming up for the franchise agreement renewal with the utility that serves Boulder, which is Xcel, the investor-owned utility. And they basically did not renew the franchise agreement. Instead, they went out and passed a ballot measure to pay that same amount to the city, which then I think pays Xcel to continue to service, but it's not locked into a long-term agreement, so that, you know, as soon as they're ready to municipalize, they can cut over and be done with Xcel. So the city of Boulder is a really great case study to any communities that are looking to municipalize, and they, you know, the guy who runs that now is Steve Katnack, who is the former general manager for the Fort Collins Utilities, which is a municipal utility, in any case, I know Steve. I've known Steve for a long time. He used to do work for Fort Collins Utilities, and he's going to get that done out there in Boulder. And he's a really nice guy. Would be more than helpful in anybody else looking to follow their steps.
All right. Anybody else? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay.
We can hear you.
Now I know why I have two phones, because I accidentally deleted my other phone. And so I'm on a second phone. So anyhow,
Anybody else have any comments? And if you need to talk, go ahead and do a four and star on this. We're just about out of time here. All good? Okay. Well, as I said earlier, we have a call on the 14th. That's going to be interesting, and it's, again, it's a system for determining the least cost, highest performing building designs, including net zero energy and minimum CO2. And Rob Hammond and Ian Hammond Hogan will be talking about that, and we will have it online as well. So you have the link to the online presentation if you want to join it that way, but you can also listen just by phone if you want to participate in it by just phone. And then the webinar next Thursday on the 15th is going to be Samuel Golding talking about options for advancing the community choice energy in various states. And it should be an interesting presentation. So thanks for the presenters today, panel. And thanks, everybody, for coming. I hope you got something out of this information. And I hope to see you next week.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thanks.